Mr. Watkins, Real 4. We were talking about your time on as a CW candidate aboard HMS London. And we're looking at sort of a typical day, and we got as far as your role as communications number in B Gun Turret. Yeah. What was? Could you describe what it was like inside the turret a bit more, and what everybody did in there? How many ratings?
It was quite amazing. I can't recall exactly how many people there were, but there were probably at least six people inside that turret. And it's very, very claustrophobic. And you have to learn exactly where everything is and what you're doing, because the lights are dim. You've only got dim lighting in there. And, the best way to describe it is like being shut in a darkened hut. But the noise when the gun went off was... Well, it shook me, didn't it? But you do get used to it. You have the ear things on, and I used to put cotton wool in my ears, try and deaden it down a bit. But on the upper deck also, if you happen to be, they used to do practice shoots, and if you were not on watch, you could stand on the upper deck and watch practice shoots. And if all the 4-inch fired off the practice shoot, you get about 8 4-inch twin guns going off together, and the sharpness of the crack was such that I was deaf for 24 hours afterwards the first time I did. I hadn't put anything in my ears, and I stood there watching their five little parachutes with things for the guns to aim at.
And what was the actual routine in the turret again? And where did the shells come from and things like that? What did everyone do?
Three or four, another one of my stations, duty stations, was being in the call-out room, which was about four decks down, and you're locked in, and you've got great bags of cordite, and you're locked in because if it's hit, then they want to contain the fire or whatever in that bit, and your life is just hard luck. And the only communication you've got is into the shell handling room, through a little tube, and you lift up a flap and you push a bag of cordite through, and that's what you're doing all the time. There were two of us in there.
It was just a ratings job.
It was just a ratings job, just pushing bags of cordite through. That's another little job I had. And way down in the depths of the ship, you've got all the shells, which had to be loaded. When you're an engine ship, it was quite an affair because the shells weighed just over 100 down the 18 shell weighs just over 100 down. And you've got to carry that and put it into a hoist and lower it right there into the shell handling room.
Did you do that job as well?
Yes. Oh, yes, I handled shells. We had to do everything. You know, we were just part of the ship's company. We weren't really CW candidates. This was seamanship training on the ship. And the shells come up in the shell handling room, and the ratings down there have got them all. They're all colour-coded. You have semi-arc, armour-piercing, anti-aircraft shells with different nose caps, and you have to set fuses on them, and they're put into great big trays and slid into the gun breech as it comes down. You slide it in, and somebody else puts the breech thing on, and it comes in and locks the shell in. Oh, well, before that goes in, the shell goes in first, and then this big bag of cordite goes in behind it, and then the breech is closed and locked, and then the gun's ready to fire. But that's going on sort of two sides, because they were twin things, so you've got, you know, two of these for B gun, two for A gun, two for Y. And they could get quite proficient, you know, you could fire off, I don't know, so many shells a minute, but they could do several rounds a minute on these twin 8-inch guns. Terrible boom, and the whole ship shook when it went off, and the terrible stench of cordite, literally now. What else did we do? We had to stream parabens every time we went to sea from Scapa Flow or anywhere else. We streamed parabens.
What does that mean? Explain what a paraben is.
A paraben is like a hollow airtight torpedo shaped metal, like a big whale. Well, it's about 10 foot long and about 2 foot wide, I suppose, but it's airtight, so it's floating, and it's connected with wires to the bow of the ship, And every time you leave harbour, you stream your parabains, and they go out either side. We were a cruiser, and we stream these parabains to about 60 feet either side of the bow. So you've got a wire which will cut through any floating any mines that are laid, and the parabain lines slice through, or at least drag the mines to the end where there's a big cutting blade, I think, and they hoped that they'd be cut and they'd bob to the surface to cut through the lines. But that was a routine that we had, you had to get into every time we left harbour. It was stream parabains without parabains, and they had to be manhandled on derricks. They didn't have any power there. You had to do it all with hand ropes and swing the derrick out over the side and swing the parabain and lower the parabain into the water. And then the wire would be run round to the nose, the bull nose of the ship, and then lowered down on the wire. So the actual streaming was done at sea level and not up in the air at the top of the bow. And that's a routine I had to get into, streaming parabains. And of course, we had to take them in. Again, every time we came into harbour, it was in parabain. That's quite a routine.
Any other routine jobs, you know, action station style jobs? The 8-inch gun, the B turret, but anything else?
The B turret, yeah. What else was there? Oh, we were allowed to actually steer the ship for a bit. We had little quarter-hour sessions where we were taken down. It was 3 or 4 decks down. It was way down in the bow of the ship where the main steering was. And you've got your, you know, from the bridge, you get the big voice pipe coming down, and the voice carried very well up and down. You could see quite plainly the orders coming down, and you'd steer whatever course they set on this huge wheel. But it was all locked in with double lot of armour around it to protect it. So it was way down the bows of the ship. And there was also an after steering position to take over in case the forward position got hit or damaged. You'd get an after steering position as well, similar sort of thing. And we used to go out in the North Sea, and we went to the Mads once, a couple of miles from Cornwall. And a little incident there.
Well, tell me about the whole thing. I mean, the whole Russian convoy.
Well, we met up with another one. I can't remember the number of it now, but we were sort of shadowy, because one of the main things they were worried about was the Tirpitz coming out. And we used to do patrols shadowing the Tirpitz with, you know, taking aircraft spotting of where it was. And once we went out from Reykjavik in Iceland and went right up into the Arctic Circle beyond Spitsbergen, supposedly shadowing the Tirpitz. We didn't know a lot about it, but we didn't get a lot of information. We were just a rating, you just did your day's work. And we had an admiral on board as well, on the run. We carried an admiral, so there were high faults going on in the boardroom, no doubt. But ours was just a menial job.
And what do you remember? How close to the convoy would you be? Because you weren't part of the actual escort, were you, or were you?
I think we were at one time. Yeah, we were finished up in Murmansk anyway, because when we tied up to a buoy there, I believe, off of Murmansk, and they invited some Russian sailors on board, and as CW candidates, we were attached to a Russian sailor. I had a big, tall, 6-foot, blonde lad. We could only speak in sign language to each other and smile and grin and whatever. But we were instructed to give them a tour of the ship, but to keep them well away from the radar and the radio room. So they were allies, but they didn't like to tell them too much about how the ship was run.
And how did you find the Russian?
Oh, this chap, he was a very genial lad. The comedy was... they'd laid out tables in the aircraft hangar to give them a nice slap-up tea, and I'm sure it was twice as much food as they ever got on board the Russian ships. But I sat down opposite this chappy, and we had pots of tea and coffee and cakes and jam and all sorts there. And they served the Russians in their glass, so they had Russian tea, you know, in a real big tall glass of Russian tea. And he smiled in appreciation and picked up a spoon and took a big spoonful of strawberry jam and stirred it into his tea and drank it with great relish. Yes, he was a happy lad.
Did you get ashore at all at Murmansk?
No, I don't think there was much to go ashore for there. You know, I don't think you were allowed outside the harbour anyway. They probably had a small, you know, unit stationed there, but there was really nothing to go ashore for in Murmansk. Possibly a canteen, maybe, but I never joined them or stayed on board.
How did you find the weather in the Arctic Circle?
Cold, very, very cold. There was ice all over the upper deck. And I recall, we had a very pleasant trip actually. We came back, and this was one of our Shadowing the Tirpitz trips when we came back from Spitsbergen. And we went into Akureyri on the north coast of Iceland. And it was beautiful. You know, it was as though suddenly we were on a cruise in peacetime. We were in this beautiful field right at the end, looking picture postcard town of Akureyri. And we stayed there a couple of days. I think refueling. I think they had some big refueling barges there. We took on more oil. And it was beautiful. It was a little, you know, a few days of peace in the war. And then we came back to Valfjord and Reykjavik. And I recall it was about 3 o'clock in the middle of the night when we were called to stations to enter harbour, as it were, drop anchor. And you had to put gloves on because there was ice on the ground. If you touched metal with your bare skin, it tore your skin off, you know, you stuck to it. So you had to put gloves on. That was impressive upon us. I think most of us did it. But it was very, very cold. You stuck on what we called scabber scanties, which were half inch thick, long woolen pants. You got on the upper deck and it was mighty cold, blowing, and it was grim. The sleet as well coming down. And you had to manhandle the ropes and the wires and everything that entailed getting the anchor up. And you unhook the anchor and put it on a big brake slip after it was all up. But it was cold and you needed everything you could get on yourself. Couple coat and thick woolens and scarves and balaclava helmets and everything.
Were you, during these convoy or that convoy, these convoys, were you attacked by U-boats or air at all?
I think we closed up reaction stations all the time, but certainly by air. But I don't think we were attacked. They were spotter planes. They were spotter planes for the U-boats. That's what we thought anyway. You could see these things going reasonable and Charlie going round and round the convoy. They just kept out of gun range, and we just sat and looked at each other virtually.
But it wasn't followed up with an air raid, or?
Yes, usually an air raid or something like that. They get bombs dropping, and there was one ship that a tank that went up. And we saw that was several miles away, and we didn't take part in any rescue operations. It was mainly the work of the poor little destroyers who were hunting around like little whippets.
What were the air raids like? Do you recall?
No, I don't. I was below decks then anyway, and you know.
You'd be on the B turret.
I was in the turret probably. I didn't see anything, and just heard afterwards that there'd been an air attack or something.
And U-boats? Any particular?
I think there was a U-boat. Well, there certainly were U-boats in the area. Yes, but again, you know, you were closed up at an actual station. You didn't know or see anything. You just heard a few rumours after it just happened, and they didn't tell you a lot, really. You know, you just got on with it. You were just sort of part of the machinery that made the ship work, and you weren't called to conferences to have it all explained afterwards. You were just part of the machinery that ran the ship. And
did you have any? What was your cruising station? I suppose, you know, action station in the B turret or the shell room.
Yeah.
What about cruising? Weren't?
I can't really remember, to be honest. I know I was in B gun turret. I was in the shell handling room. Oh yeah, I was in there for a bit. Shell handling room and then the cordite room. I don't think I was doing anything. I wasn't a trained gunner at that time, so I couldn't go on the Erlikans or anything like that. And you were just there as a bog.
What about routine duties, cleaning chip, that sort of thing, chipping ice off?
That's right. Well, every time you got into harbour, of course, there were working parties, and you spent all the forenoon with a chipping hammer, chipping off rusty paint and repainting. that went on non-stop, you know, there was never any let-up. There was always a working party chipping paint off and repainting the red lead and then the camouflage colour over the top, grey or light grey. And that went on, and another thing I can't remember how many months I was on the London. But eventually, I got the call.
Any particular incidents from the London you recall? Not really? There's nothing in your notes other than...
No, I cannot recall that. It was routine stuff. It was chipping hammers, painting, in the turret, or in the show room, or in the Cordite room. And that was it. And you ate, slept, and you did your watches, and that was it. And you were in Iceland. We went ashore once in Iceland and had quite a nice time there.
What, in Reykjavik? In Reykjavik. What was that like?
Well, it was very nice. It was peaceful, lots of lights. There was no blackout in Reykjavik, and all the lights blaze away. Well, that seems to seem very strange to us, you know, coming out of blacked-out England and suddenly to approach a shore that was all headlights and streetlights and cars going back and forth and the lights on. It was very strange. And another thing I recall also was the joy of having freshly baked bread on board the London after the wartime national loaf of City Street, you know, we all had to get used to this brown, crumbly loaf that went stale after about 6 hours. But on the London, they had their own bakery, it was all fresh white, lovely smelling bread. If you felt seasick, go and stand by the bakery and smell the lovely fresh bread being baked. It was a joy.
Did you have much? You don't seem to have had much problem with seasickness at the time.
Not on the London, no, I didn't. Mainly a feeling of queasiness because also what with the hatches leaking and all the cockroaches, you also used to get, every time you went to sea, you got the terrible stench of diesel oil coming up in the engine room. And that was, I found that very sick making. It was very, you know, I used to long to get on the upper deck, you know, I used to, all my spare time I spent on the upper deck near the bakery, smelling these lovely smells and getting some fresh air in my guts.
Would you say it was a happy ship?
Reasonably so, yeah. There was no misdemeanors or anything, no mutinies. We had to learn another thing. We also did a bit of rowing practice from there. I think this was the CW Bank as well. And every time in harbour, they used to swing out the main boom from the side of the ship. It was lashed to the upper deck. You know, when you went to sea, but they swung the boom out on wires and stays. And to get in the boat, you had to walk along the boom about 3/4 of the way along and then climb down a rope ladder, which was about probably 60 feet down to the sea. And that's what you're big getting used to. But you did it, you know, you did these things as you were ordered to, and you just did it without thinking. Took a deep breath and did things.
And what was the rowing practice like?
Well, we just rode around the ship a few times. It was all a bit academic. It made a break from the routine of the rest of the ship.
How did shipboard routine change in harbour? Or at Scapa, I suppose, was used.
At Scapa, well, there must have been watches because, the radio room and the signals, all those people had to do watches. The gun screws, I think, just cleaned their guns in harbour. I think they did watches. So, I don't know, I think there were only certain people that did watch keeping in harbour. Like the gangway had to be, you know, manned, and the I don't know what else, the signals, and the radio room. There'd be certain people that had to do watches in harbour, but for the seamen, it was mainly work parties and keeping the ship clean and tidy and freshly painted as far as we could.
Would you go ashore at Scapa?
We got ashore a couple of times at Kirkwall by a trot boat. They used to send a little steam trot boat and you climb down the side and down the steam. There was very little there though. You walk around the town for a bit, exercise your legs, have a pint of beer in the canteen there, and that was about it. You know, there wasn't a lot there.
Did some men drink more than perhaps you might have done?
Oh, indeed, yes. There were several drunks had to be sort of manhandled back on board and hauled up the side of the ship on a rope. They'd be on a charge, of course, for coming back drunk. What else did we do on the London?
Were you ever actually in action? Because, you know, you mentioned firing the guns. Was that always training, or was it...?
I think there must have been some action. I think there must have been some action, because we did meet... there was attacks. I think there were U-boat attacks. But it's very, very vague, and I really can't recall.
And what about, were you still learning, because you mentioned going through the seamanship manual, were you still swatting?
We were still swatting, yes, and I did by the end of it, pretty well learned the seamanship manual, cover to cover. You could recite all the flags and describe them and say what they were used for, and come into anchors and cables, and we knew how to tie the ship up to more than one buoy. There were routines.
And were you helped in it? I mean, did you have an instructional officer to help?
Usually a chief petty officer, yeah, would go through it with you. And if you had any questions, they'd be there to ask you. But it were mainly self-taught, you know. We used to do, I used to do about an hour a day, spotting my manual and reading notes. I had copious notes written and all things.
And would your fellow CW candidates, would they sort of help you?
The same thing, yeah. We used to get together and you know, quiz each other and see what we'd learned that we didn't know. And we got on pretty well together.
No, ordinary ratings wouldn't be doing that, would they?
No, they wouldn't be doing that. They'd be, I don't know what they did in their spare time, read books, or some of the old hands used to make little table mat things out of silks. That used to be a popular pastime with some of the old three badge ABs, you know, the long-serving people.
How did you get on with the rest of the crew?
Oh, pretty well, pretty well. You muck in together, you know, you muck in together. And you make the best of it. You make the best of it. But I don't know how many months I was on the London, but I don't think I'd recognise anybody on there now.
Have you any idea at all how long you were with them?
Well, it was some months. It was some months. It must have been from about March to November or something. 43? Yeah, something like that.
So right across the summer?
Right across the summer of 43, yeah.
And what happened when you came to, you know, you came to the end? What happened?
Well, we were just, we had a signal one day, and the petty officer came and said, oh, you Rangers have got your draft come through, you know, and we were all together and getting your kit pack buses and sort of thing, and that was it. And we just climbed over the side, and our kit bags were loaded into the boat, and off we went back to Scapa Flow and got the train back to Chatham.
What happened when you got to Chatham?
Well, when we got to Chatham, we went to the barracks and back into Collingwood. And I think we were there for a couple of weeks. Had a few classes there, back in the classroom a bit. And then we were taken from there down to King Alfred, which was a private home. That was the wartime officers' training unit. And they used Lancing College as the training base there. But we were sent down on the train. Oh, we had to hand in our hammocks. There was padding officers. We didn't have hammocks anymore. We handed those in.
So you get there November or December 43?
Yeah, I think so. Or...
a bit later?
I really don't know. I can't fit it down in my mind. It was sometime around there.
Were you at King Alfred's at Christmas? That might be a way of...
I think it was just before. I think it was just before Christmas we started at King Alfred. And we were put in private billets. And this is a rather crunch of my story, because I think there were four of us in one house. And the lady that ran the house was the wife of a naval officer, and she ran this boarding thing. No, they got paid for it, putting these ratings up. And we were in a road around the back streets of Hove. And the following morning we were picked up, we had breakfast. Oh, the nub of the story is that this lady had a young son, about 9 or 10 years old. And she said, oh yes, I'll introduce you to my son, you know, I want to get his name now. He's just got over having the measles, she said. And, oh, yes, well, it was a bright place little lad, and we didn't think anything more about it. Anyway, we sat down, had a meal, and this little lad was at the table, had our evening meal, went to bed. And I found that I had to, the other waiting had another room, and I had to share a room for the night with this little lad, I think it was at boarding school, and the following week he was due to go back to his boarding school. But anyway, I shared a room with this little lad. And the following day we were picked up in a naval lorry and taken to Larson College. And we had an introductory lecture by the lieutenant, and he said, you know, gave us an outline of what we were going to do, and how many weeks we'd be there. And then said, oh, well, your course begins next Monday morning, you know, sharp at 9 o'clock. We would be bustled into the college at 9. And that was it. And then, as a finale, he said, any of you ratings that live in the area, of course, you're quite welcome to take a few days leave and go home. So my ears shot up, and this was on, I think, Monday or Tuesday night, and we weren't starting until the following Monday. So I saw the necessary officer, got a chit, and I came on leave. My mother was amazed, you know, to see me. And it was lovely to be home and see her. 2 days later, I woke up, and I felt terrible. I've got spots and things, and I've caught the measles from this lad. Got the measles. Called the doctor in. Yes, measles. So, there were no telephones. I didn't know who to get in touch with. My doctor gave me a certificate, and all I put on it was commanding officer, HMS King Alfred, Hove, Sussex. Send it off. And a couple of days later, I had a little letter come through. You're hereby granted 3 weeks sick leave from this point. So there I was. And fortunately, I don't know what the doc gave me, but within a week, I was up and running. You know, I was all right. I got all the spots off for it, just over a week. And I started feeling better. I was going for walks and doing a lot of shopping and things like that. And then I think I had 2 days left of my sick leave, and I suddenly had an urgent telegram. No telephones, no telegram. What was I? I don't remember. 444-990, still remember the number. Watkins, report immediately to Chatham Barracks to join draft. DE-26, I think it was. And I was in a flummox. I knew I was supposed to go back to King Alfred, but I got no one to get in touch with by phone, you know, for a quick response. And we were always, it was drilled into us like that, always follow the last order. Even if it, you know, whatever it does, follow the last order. And being a bit innocent, I don't know, I went to Chatham. It was, you know, this telegram. I presented myself at Chatham. And eventually found myself with a chief petty officer in charge of the draft. And I said, I'm sorry, chief, I've got this telegram. He said, but I'm supposed to be at Brighton doing an OTC course. He said, oh, sorry, mate, I can't help that. He said, I've got you down as a draft here. And I was on this draft, and I didn't know what to do about it. So he said, take it up with your captain when you get on board. So there I was, you know, I was just an ordinary seaman, and you do what you're told. So I had to draw another hammock. I haven't got a hammock, but I had to draw a hammock, and within a couple of days we were off. And I thought, I'd get down to Portsmouth and try as quickly as I could get a word to the captain and hopefully be transferred back to Brighton. That was my thoughts. We got down to Portsmouth, and we were put on a troop ship. First stop, New York. Oh dear, and, you know, I was out of the depth, you know, I stopped thinking about it for a bit. I was on the draft and I couldn't do anything about it. So
you were no longer a cadet?
Well, I didn't know anyway.